map on the board is sort of from memory, so there are some mistakes in it. I don't have Hungary in there, Czechoslovakia, and these smaller republics I don't have in there, but basically have Poland up in its place, up in the northern tier of Europe. And when you go to bed at night at 9 o'clock, the sun is just setting, and you get up in the morning at 4 o'clock, which I didn't, but if you did get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, the sun is just getting and just rising. So you have a northern feel to it, and it's mostly in the morning for sure jacket weather and long sleeve, could be long sleeve and short sleeve in the middle of the day weather. So it is really quite different than what we have here. So we enjoyed our Polish thing. Now, remember, maybe you don't know this, the Polish thing was kind of a Mennonite tour. It was a heritage tour. And the one in Italy was just a Trafalgar tour, that just probably an outstanding tour. I recommend anybody, probably whatever I should say, the best tour of what I know. They've only been on one of theirs, but it is really well done. So, and I hear there's a group going next year or two from our church going on this Italy thing. So maybe I could go along. I think my wife will stay home, though. She didn't like Italy as much as I did. So this is a special production. It's nothing really in our lesson, although it does fit it to some extent. What you see pictured here is the Gdańsk harbor. And when I say harbor, it's just one of the fingers of water that comes inland from the harbor. And it's deep water, deep enough water that, you know, these tall ships can sail in there. And I got to say, I was really, really, we were really surprised at Gdańsk, how enjoyable a place that is. I didn't know that. There's so many jokes about Polish people. I don't know why, because I don't think it's justified. I don't know why. I'll give you a comment maybe later. But it is a really beautiful country, a beautiful city. The people are wonderful. All the stuff you think about Polish people, you know, forget if it's negative, it's all good. So this is just a picture of that. So we're going to talk about Poland a little bit. Again, this fits with my study. Modern-day Poland is quite different than the multifaceted past. First, the borders have often been rearranged by her aggressive neighbors. Now look at this, 1772, 73, 75, 1795, and there's a break. And by the way, those of you that have Mennonite interests here, that's where the shift came in Poland when they started leaving it. Because the government was making statements against their particular people. And so that's when many of them went to the Ukraine. That's my ancestors went to the Ukraine, and that's why we went. I wanted to go back to Poland to see this place. They basically became a non-country for 123 years. They were, and I'll show this to you, but this is what happened. Non-country for 123 years, and then after World War I, when the Allies divided up the World War I war territory, Poland came back to life in 1918. It existed as a free independent nation until 1939 when Hitler invaded Poland on September 1. And it lost its independence under Nazism. And then, after World War II, Russia had also invaded Poland from the east, and it never regained its independence because the Russians occupied Poland from 1945 on until 1998. And that's when we look at the USSR collapsed. The Berlin Wall came down. So from that time on, Poland now has been, again, an independent, unchallenged country. So it has a very, very assorted past. So at times, 123 years, it completely disappeared, only restored in the 1918 Poland, and then we had the war after that, and the communism followed it. It's interesting about Poland, different than the Ukraine. Russia occupied both of those countries. But in Poland, they weren't there long enough, I don't think, to really crush the spirit of the people. Whereas in Ukraine, they were there long enough, and maybe they didn't have the resources or depth of resources to resist it. So what happened to Ukraine, people collapsed under the pressure of communism, and the people lost their spirit. That did not happen in Poland. Our guide was saying that when the communists were here, we know they were here in our territory. You know, we weren't going to become like them. They weren't going to become like us. So they were just biding their time. You didn't have that feeling like in the Ukraine. All right, so what Poland suffered under communism, but it didn't get affected by it. Then we have more history coming up here. In the meantime, these territories of Poland had been called Prussia, East Prussia, Austria, Ukraine, Germany, all reflecting the names of the bordering neighbors. And one of the reasons I think that Poland has gotten to have somewhat of a negative connotation is because it never had a strong army. And when you don't have a strong army, you don't have a strong nation. And when you have a strong nation, you look like weak people, and weak people are easily conquered by the neighbors, and that's exactly what happened. So a strong army probably is at the bottom of those Polish jokes because they couldn't defend themselves. Just a picture of these two countries, Germany and Poland, as they are today, and the pink loops are actually the tracks that we followed. We went north to Gdansk from Warsaw, and then as far south as Krakow, which had nothing to do with our heritage tour, but it had to do with historic. So we had been there earlier, and we were back there because the tour, that was part of the tour. Now, these are the partitions. You have three colors. You have the brown, you have the, call it the bluish, greenish, bluish, and then the green. So the brown is the darker to the lighter is the invasion of Russia into Polish territory. The blue is the invasion of the Germans or Prussia taking over the Polish area. And then the greens from the south is from Austria. So when you're done, there's really nothing left of Poland by 1795. Because of these pressures in Europe, and this comes out of the Reformation, it comes out of the Anabaptist pressures, you know, Catholic pressures on the Protestant, and the people started to migrate because they were looking for places that were more agreeable to their religion. So we have these migrations. I don't have a date here. I'm just going to guess probably the late 19th century, so let's say 1850, 1900, somewhere in there. We have the places where the Lutherans went, where the Catholics went or were congregated, and we have the Mennonites, where the arrow is. That's where our ancestors came from, in the areas that were mixed, and it's above the Black Sea, which now is the Ukraine. So there are many people in this period of time in late 19th century, 1800s, that people were scattered because there's such an instability in Europe that people went to places that were safer. And Russia was a place where people could go because of the early policy of Catherine the Great allowed people to come into territories they had conquered away from the Muslims in South Russia, and they needed people to populate that. And so they allowed a lot of people from German-speaking people to come in. So this is German-speaking settlement groups in Eastern Europe. So you see they went east because of the Russian invitation largely. Now, Lech Walesa, we know him from the guy that organized the shipyard workers and actually started to break the back of the communism in Poland. And this is the shipyards where he worked, and there are no ships being built anymore. The cranes are sitting there as monuments, as memorials. So it's kind of a sad thing to see, but as it is always in commerce, these ships, these centers of industry change. Now they're in Japan, where the ships are being built and so forth. So, but this is where it started. Lech Walesa was the one that really started the pushback on communism, and it started in Poland and Gdańsk in Poland. When we're in Poland, 90% Catholic, and when we're in Italy, it's probably 100% Catholic. You can almost say that. And there's a place in Poland we visited in, whatever, 2003, I think it was. It's the Black Madonna at Częstochowa. And you are really depressed when you run into Catholicism everywhere. It's wall to wall. And it is a manipulative religion. Maybe we'll talk more about it next week. But it's a manipulative religion as far as I'm concerned. When we got there, this is just when we were there in 2003, you couldn't, I mean, it was so packed you couldn't get in, you know. I mean, you couldn't, like, with muscle your way in. This time was a little less people, but it was packed with people, and this picture doesn't show it. I want to point out to you a couple of things. In the middle of the picture, you have this picture frame. That's where the Black Madonna is. And the Black Madonna, when it looked like it's on the, I have a picture here, I didn't drink at my pointer. There she is, and it's black because the wood got darker. Over hundreds of years, it gets darker and darker and darker, and it's supposed to have miraculous powers, which, of course, they are very superstitious. But anyway, that picture is behind this screen that looks like a picture frame. And they open it up at certain times in the week, I don't even say day, certain times of the week, and so people can come in and look at it. Now, on the left here, we see down here, these people, they're not midgets. They're on their knees. They're on their knees walking on their knees in the direction they're going so they could go behind the altar, make a right turn, look back towards the Madonna, and there's a medallion on the wall, and people get up and kiss it. And they get, you know, back down on their knees and walk out, and then you see on the right-hand side people are coming out. And I say, well, why don't they just leave that thing open all the time? If the Black Madonna is such a blessing to the world, why don't they leave it open all the time? Does it get tired? Does it need to go to bed? Does it need to go to the bathroom? See how manipulative it is? I mean, anybody would stop. Why don't you just leave it open? If it's such a good thing for people, why don't you just leave it open? Well, our guide in Italy, and this is next week's lesson, our guide in Italy says the Catholics in Italy, and that's going to be true in Poland, do not know their Bible. This is our guide. They do not know their Bible, and their religion is full of superstition. And that's exactly right. So why do we stop here? I have no idea. It's on the tour group. Well, one of the things that you always should remember that when you study history, the only thing that keeps you on track on history is to watch the Jews. I would say the rest of it's irrelevant. It's to a large extent it is, as far as the Bible is concerned. So we watch the Jews. Now, in Poland, you know that the Polish people, the Polish country, was the harbor for the Jews. We'll talk about that in a minute. In the ghetto, where the Jewish people lived in Warsaw, which has been destroyed and now been rebuilt with normal Gentile population, they have opened a Polish-Jewish museum. Jews were Polish, okay? And this museum reflects their entire history in being in Poland. And it was in the Warsaw ghetto that this occurs. And it's a wonderful museum. And it takes you a couple hours to go through it. And if you really spent a lot of time at it, you can spend all day there. But it's not about Jews as a whole. It's about Jews in Poland, okay? Very wonderful. Europe uses a lot of glass panels like this. So it's a wonderful building. It's on the site of the Holocaust, the ghetto. And in this, they have recreated the synagogue in the museum. Very ornate, elaborate, probably meant to replicate the synagogue that was in what we call the Jewish ghetto. And we took a cab from our hotel to the museum. It was raining. And then on the way back, it was quit raining. We said to ourselves, let's just walk back. It's probably about 3 miles. Let's just walk back. You know, you see a lot more when you walk. So we walked along, and I don't know, was it you, Wanda? Or one of the ladies saw, look at this. You did? Donna? Okay, your sister. So look at this. There's something on the pavement looked like this. It says a ghetto wall. So we had just crossed the ghetto wall, and this is a self-guided tour. So we looked up, and we saw this little sign on the side here, you know, kind of, there it is, down here. I should have got my pointer out. You see my pointer down here? All right, that's where it is. That's this thing. And it shows the shape of the ghetto, and then, you know, words about it. But anyway, this is in this vicinity, so we walked across the wall of the ghetto and did not realize it. And there's a picture of that. All right. Now, what's always when you see the ghetto, the Warsaw ghetto, this is the picture you usually see. On the right hand, you see the bridge that goes over the sliver of land that's not the ghetto. But so to get from this side of the ghetto to this side of the ghetto, you got to go over this bridge, which is what this is. You couldn't walk across the street; that was too risky for people. For the Jews could escape doing that, so they made a bridge for them to walk over. So anyway, that's where we are. If you ever see anything about the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw, you always see this picture. Now, the Poles, goodness, time goes fast. The Polish prince, I don't read all of this, but so I've got to give you the important thing. In 1264, the Jews were allowed personal freedom in Poland. Now, that's a long time ago, 800 years ago. That's a long time ago. They were allowed personal freedom. And this personal freedom was enforced and reinforced in 1334, 1453, 1539. So we have a couple of 300-year period where the Jews were at home in Poland, not persecuted. Now, you think about the Jewish history, that's really quite astounding. They'd have that long a period of time. So when you have that long a time where there is no problem for the Jews, they go there. And so the Jewish population built and built and built and built in Poland. So it was a home for Jews for 300 years, you might say uncontested, even though they are in the diaspora, they were pretty well content. So it was called in Latin a paradise for the Jews. It became a shelter for the persecuted and expelled European Jewish communities and home for the world's largest Jewish community. Now think ahead a little bit where Hitler goes to exterminate the Jews. You think that? That's where he went. First land he conquered by military action was Poland. Okay. So World War II saw Poland partitioned between Nazi Germany. September 1, 1939, Hitler attacked. And 20-some days later, Russia attacks from the Hitler from the west, Stalin from the east, and a pincer move on Poland. The war resulted in the death of one-fifth of the Polish population, with 90% or 3 million of the Jewish people killed. 90%. 20% of the normal Polish people and 90% of the Jewish people were killed. Leaves 10%. All right. So where did these Jews live? Sometimes we have we use the phrase beyond the pale. The pale is where Jews lived. And so what we have here is a picture of the densities. And if you had time, I could point out to you the darkest on the map is the highest percentage of Jews. And the lightest would be the lowest percentage. So obviously you sort of move away from the center here. So this is the pale. Let me show it to you a little better. Remember, Dangst is up here. And so this is the pale. We go down to the Crimea. The Ukraine, and it goes up into Poland, so-called. So this would be West Russia, depending on what years we're talking about. And this could be West Germany, Austria. So this is that pale, and this is another picture of the same thing. I just want to point out where Poland is today. So the Jews and modern-day Poland, there were Jews living in that space. And I read about Mennonite history, and the many times the Mennonites were considered as odd as the Jews were because of the lack of military participation. So that made them different from the rest, made them look unpatriotic and really not citizens and all that kind of stuff. So they were treated in some ways the same way the Jews were. And they lived next to each other. The Jews and the Mennonites lived next to each other in Poland. Now, in 1881, Tsar Alexander was assassinated, and the situation for the Jews deteriorated as they were wrongly blamed by some for the assassination. Now, remember, this is the background we had for our Balfour independence of Israel. Where did this pressure come from for the Balfour to be issued? Well, it started, major issue was when Alexander was assassinated, they blamed the Jews for it. And the pogroms against the Jews began. So, this discrimination embittered the Jews to Russia society, blamed them for the death of the Tsar. In 1891, Jews were systematically expelled from Moscow, not from Russia, from Moscow. The police strictly applied the discriminatory laws, and media engaged in unbridled propaganda against the Jews. And one of the wonders of the world is the St. Peter's Church of the Spilled Blood. And when I heard about that, we were there in 2004. I looked at this Church of the Spilled Blood and said, we've got to be talking about the Savior's blood. What else would you have in a church? No, it's the Tsar's blood. Because it's on the site where he was killed as the church was built. And it has the most beautiful mosaics I've ever seen in my whole world. And that's kind of what I want to talk about next year. How can Christianity, that's so off, as we see in Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, produce such wonderful works of art? All right. All right, from the Passover program in 1903 on, pogroms became government policy and reached a peak in October 1905. Russian individuals authored the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was falsely used, but God used in a positive way. In 1903, a major anti-Semitic forgery popular in some communities to this day, Henry Ford himself funded the printing and distribution of 500,000 copies in the United States. How many of you guys drive Fords? I never have driven a Ford in my life, and that's because of... No, I'm just kidding. But Henry Ford was anti-Semitic. All right. The census of 1897 showed that Jews in Russia numbered 5 million, constituted slightly 4% of the total Russian population, though disproportionately in the pale, up to 18%. Half of the world's Jews. all this set up the Jewish Zionist movement, a homeland for the Jews. Remember, that pressure in Russia drove some to the United States and some to Israel, and some were caught in Poland. So my recent declaration series picked up here. It was obvious to Theodor Herzl that the Jews had failed to be assimilated. Very important point. They had failed to be assimilated and become a normal people. Could never be assimilated. They failed to be normalized by the constituents in Russia. They had no chance in the future to be assimilated elsewhere, and he gave up. So he joined, in a sense, the Christian Zionists who had started already movement, getting Israel back to their land. And our series on the Balfour is that story to the establishment of the Jewish state in 1948. Now, Jews today in Poland, hard to tell. There are maybe 15 million Jews in the world today. There are about, I've seen 8,000, 10,000. No one really knows how many Jews there are in Poland because some don't want to be known as Jews. Some are Jews and don't know it. You know, so they're using this figure. And in Krakow, which is close to Auschwitz, they say about 1,000 Jews. Again, they're kind of hiding. They're kind of shell-shocked, maybe, shall we say. So now we have a little less than half, or let's say half in Israel, Jews, and half, the other half, pretty well lives in the United States. They've been pretty well emptied everywhere else. You know, not very many Jews live in Egypt anymore, or Algiers, or Morocco, you know, or in Babylon, for that matter. So they've just pretty well been separated out to either Israel or America, United States. There's no doubt that the state of Israel has been an attractive alternative to living with personal persecution. That's why they're in the United States. They're not persecuted here. Yet the Jews in the United States have lived relatively free of Semitism, anti-Semitism. Only in the United States have the Jews never been expelled. Thus, a mass migration has not occurred. They're happy and comfortable here. Some of them are atheists. While the return of the Jews to the land has begun, it will not reach its end until another wave of pogroms, and we call it the tribulation, will occur when at last they will receive their Messiah. Ezekiel 38:39. Well, when you're in Poland, we cannot avoid Krakow, Auschwitz, and Birkenau, which is a major attraction. It is no secret what happened there. And the camp is being rebuilt in part of it. When we were there in 2003, I think it was, or 4, I always get mixed up. We basically saw this gatehouse, as when you always see in all the movies, where you see the trains pulling in with a load of Jews hanging out of the windows, if there were windows, and loading them, separating the people, either to the gas chambers or to work. And at that time, when we were there in 2003, there were no other buildings except this gatehouse. There was a fence around it. Now, they have rebuilt, I may be wrong here, because I don't remember seeing barracks out there, because I know they were all destroyed. So they have been rebuilt no matter what. So all these barracks have been rebuilt. And you see these foundations are in front here. It could be barracks, but also this is where the crematoriums were. And I asked, you know, sort of stupidly asked, well, are they going to rebuild the crematoriums, you know, as memorials? And they said no, and I think that's probably right. I mean, it's something they just can't do. So this is the Auschwitz. This is actually Birkenau. We always call it Auschwitz. And the famous sign that was stolen a few years ago, now it's been replicated. It's Arbeit macht frei. In other words, work makes you free. It's a ploy for the Jews to enter Auschwitz and supposedly be taken care of. Of course, the opposite's true. In 1942, they decided that they were going to, Jewish solution was to gas the Jews because there was no other efficient way to do it. And it was in this facility that the first Cyclone B gas was used. It's still standing. It's a room that's no bigger than this room, a little bit different shape. And it is a place where there were ovens where they were, you know, burned the bodies. That still stands. But this is not the one that really did the bad work because those are much, much larger. Again, this is a fiction. The other way, you see the barracks on the left being rebuilt. And we're in the area of Schindler's List. You know that story of how that Mr. Oskar Schindler kept the Jews from going to gas chambers by giving them jobs and keeping them busy. So there's a museum there now. The museum doesn't say much about Schindler's manufacturing there because most of it's been removed, but the building is there. but his office is there, so it's more or less a memorial to the event rather than a museum of Schindler himself. And remember, what Schindler did, they made pots and pans, and so this is what we have displayed here. Okay, now, the Jewish restaurant, run by Gentiles, provided Jewish music for the evening. Oh, that's silly. It is a bit strange, now this is my feelings, it's a bit strange to find the Gentiles who have so mercilessly persecuted the Jews doing so much to preserve their memory. Is it tourism?
Yes.
Is it guilt and reparations? Yes. Is it not something supernaturally strange that an event of the magnitude of the Holocaust just cannot be ignored? Although they try. The Holocaust deniers live. Now, it seems that there is a capitalization of the event, a restaurant. They're making money doing this. As we ate in the Jewish restaurant in Krakow, frankly, I sat there, and it was probably halfway through that I figured out that these people that are working here and serving us are not Jews. They're Gentiles. Pictures on the wall, Jewish people, Jewish families, you know, Jewish decoration, Jewish lace. I said, these are Gentiles doing this. I mean, I really had to pinch myself. This is not Jewish. This is Gentiles acting like Jews. All right, so it seems like there's a capitalization of the event. As we ate in the Jewish restaurant, quote, quote, I shake myself to remind me that the owners and servers were not Jewish, but everything else was. So outside the restaurant, we look to the right. We see the synagogue still standing there in Krakow. And we look towards the restaurant where we ate, and Ariel, remember Fruitenbaum, that's the name of his ministry, I should have looked up what that word means, is in Hebrew on this restaurant, which is a Gentile restaurant. See, they're capitalizing on the Jewish history here. Now, why? You know, can they forget it? Is there this guilt feeling, we need to do this, we need to preserve their, or is this something supernatural that God is doing so people won't forget? So we sat in and see the pictures on the wall. You see the man with the beard back here, a Jewish person. All these are Jewish pictures. By the way, there's Mark Jansen, if you want to know Leona what it looks like. These are the people on this tour, all right? And then one of my favorite pictures I took is that one. Why, I don't know, but it captures a Jewish spot. You know, outside we have the, what do you call those, mountain ash. We have them grow here, you know, with little red berries or fruit on them. And it's just beautiful. And inside we have these dark greens and these rich colors, earth tone colors, and their Jewish stuff on the side. I just, you know, the Victorian lamp. I mean, here it is. This is Jewish personified. That's how I like the picture. It's in that restaurant. There's another camp. I don't know about this one. There's a lot of camps in Poland, many camps. This is one called Stutthof in northern Poland. It was a camp that was huge, and a lot of it have been rebuilt, and some of it still stands. It was not a death camp, it was a concentration camp as such. And we visited that. Okay, now some editorial remarks. When visiting Poland with its pro-Jewish and anti-Jewish history, got both, remember, it is almost as if the Jews hang around to haunt the people for their past. The Polish government has made it a punishable crime to talk of any blame laid on the Poles for any aspect of the Holocaust in their own land. In other words, it is a crime to say Polish death camps. You will go to jail or pay a fine. What they want you to say is Nazi death camps. Now, and this has been very highly disputed because now it's almost like as if they want to rewrite history, but they don't want to be blamed for something they did to the Jews. And the question is, were the Poles complicit in this or not? And maybe we don't know. It's probably go down to the individual person. Now, as the Polish government is sensitive about assuming any responsibility for the Holocaust, Europe is continuing to harbor anti-Semitism in the Boycott Israel movement, the Boycott Divestment Sanctions movement, BDS. And I don't think it's getting a lot of gravity, but it doesn't go away. So now you don't buy Israeli produce, you don't buy the strawberries, you don't buy their, you know, you don't buy anything, that, especially that came from the what you call the occupied territories. If it's made there, it's, you know, it's forbidden. Now, it was a, now go back to my Mennonite stuff here. I'm sorry, for those of you that have any interest in this. I have a, it was a little strange that we, on a Mennonite tour, visited the Jewish sites without comment. And if I have a criticism about the whole tour, was no one said anything about anything. You went there and looked. But got to say something. Nothing. Get back on the bus. Go to the next place. Look. Get back on the bus and look. Nothing is said. We had Bible verses in the morning, one from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament, written, read first in German and then spoken in English. But no comment. No comment. No context for those verses. Just read the verses, closed the Bible, sat down. No prayer. Nothing. Now, the Mennonites historically have been pro-Palestinian. That's not a misprint. Mennonites historically have been pro-Palestinian, are quick to blame the Jews for the dilemma in the Middle East. I kept my mouth shut. My wife will be witness to that. I was a good boy through the whole time, or a disobedient one, I don't know which. I didn't say anything. I said, I'm not here to cause trouble. But there were no comments about anything by the leadership. I suppose it fits the philosophy, the Mennonite philosophy of non-confrontation, which appears to be rooted in their peace and pacifism convictions. The Mennonite World Conference in Kansas City last year could not agree on a statement regarding the Palestinian issue. They attempt to take a middle road and fail the courage to do the right thing. And with that, I'll take your questions. And you have 3 minutes. Just kidding. All right, it was just interesting. It was just interesting to me, and that's probably not what most of you care about, but it's interesting to me that they try to take this middle-of-the-road viewpoint, and you know what happens when you stand in the middle of the road? You ever notice that? Both lanes of traffic, you know, get it from both sides. So they're trying to do something probably not possible. Yep. Well, the Poles would say the Germans came in and did it. The Poles are as much of a victim as the Jews were. Okay. Well, okay, that's what they're trying to say. Now, Jews probably disagree with that to some extent because the Poles were involved in it, and I'm not going to get into the argument, but that's the issue. With anti-Semitism as rife as it is, it doesn't surprise me that the Poles were complicit in it, because why would they not be? But, like I say, I'm not going to try to take a side on that. Well, the thing of it is that when they come down, they really take the wrong road. They do support the Palestinians. And I've had arguments with some of those people in 2003. And I was the only one left on the boat that was sane. You know, the Anabaptist movement, if you ever read anything about it, they say that by the third generation, which would be 100 years at the most, all the distinctions of the new birth were gone. Doesn't mean there weren't some saved, but as a movement. So when the Mennonites came into Poland, lived there for nearly 300 years, and the Mennonite brethren came out of that because Lutheranism came into it, and a guy was preaching the name Wiest, and the Moravians, some of you know about that, they're kind of the evangelicals of the John Wesley, Jonathan Edwards periods from South Eastern Germany. They came in and they influenced some of the Mennonites, and some of those Mennonites truly experienced a born-again event. And out of that group of Mennonites, the Mennonite Brethren was formed. Our tradition, my tradition. So I see myself more a believer in the gospel than I am a Mennonite, if I look back at my history. Socially, that's the roots. I mean, you have your social roots. Those are mine. They're German, they're from Holland, Belgium. But that's not my religion. My religion is a biblical religion. Now, when it comes to the Mennonite, they don't make a distinction there. It's just the culture. It's the social life that is everything. And for us, that makes no sense to me. I mean, he said, why don't we talk about our faith? Oh, we don't talk about our faith. Why don't we engage? Well, we don't do that. They don't say that. I have a sister-in-law whose nephew was at my brother's funeral. He was from Indiana. I tried the hardest to get him to talk about what he believed. Would not do it. You could see it was on the tip of his tongue, but he pulled it back. And I goaded him. I did everything I could except beat him over the head with a club. And he wouldn't talk to me. That's so unheard of. You know, usually people talk to you. But so this is a Mennonite thing. Don't engage. Because you get engaged, then you have this conflict. And when you have this conflict, nothing good comes out of it. That's wrong. You know, there's conflict in the gospel. You can't avoid it. So I'm looking not for the conflict. I'm looking for the confrontation. I'm looking for the ideas that people have to grapple with and to go away and say, well, I don't know. It just doesn't work. So our trip to Poland was historic for us, for Heritage. I wanted to go and see that. And to that extent, it was true. I got that. But the ancestors, if you think about a branch, our ancestors left, went to Ukraine. And those that stayed in Poland, let's say half of them stayed in Poland, that's the history we saw. I mean, the houses they built, the places where they lived, that's what we saw. So, because they stayed. And by the end of World War II, all of them were gone. See, once the Mennonites have this one thing about non-resistance, this pacifism, once that's gone, once they join the military, there's no reason for them to exist. That's their distinction. That's their distinction. And so in time, the Polish government put the pressure on them for them. You know, they couldn't buy land. They couldn't marry outside the church. Guys couldn't marry into the Mennonite church because then they'd be military exempt. And they wouldn't allow them to do that. So in time, the government did push them down to the point where they didn't exist. And so now they say there aren't any left because they all were with the coming in of Germany and then coming into Russia. All the German people were pretty well decimated and moved out and became refugees in the West. A lot of them came to Canada, some went to South America and Brazil, which is South America.